Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what's led one longtime observer to describe the state of state government politics as sorry and aiming for whatever the opposite of nonchalance is? But first, the federal government announced last week it would restore the records of some number of international college and university students who are studying in the U.S. The Trump administration had previously canceled the records in a database called the Student and Exchange Visitor Information System, or SEVIS. It allows federal authorities to keep tabs on international students while they're in the country, including any criminal charges that are brought against them. Prior to the government's reversal, judges around the country had already ordered students' records to be restored. Part of the issue is that it appears to be unclear if a student whose record has been canceled is allowed to even be in the country. To talk more about this, I spoke earlier with Miriam Feldblum, president and CEO of the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration, an alliance of nearly 600 college and university presidents and chancellors around the country, including some here in Arizona. And we should note this conversation happened before the feds announced they'd restore student records. We started with what Feldblum has been hearing from university and college leaders about what's going on right now with regards to immigration and how it's impacting their institutions.
This is a very significant time for institutions. So this is a time of the year when institutions are working to recruit international students for the coming year. They're working to support their students, those who are near graduation, those who may be in their first or second years. And so this is a time when institutions are working to support and recruit international students. What we see happening is recent immigration enforcement operations, as well as the unilateral SEVIS student record terminations that are impacting thousands of students from across the country, hundreds of colleges, and it's happening in a way that is sudden, without notification to the institutions, without verifying what the information is. And what that has done is that it has upended regular processes in colleges and universities.
Does that mean that some of those schools are not able to provide the kinds of support you were talking about to students because sort of their focus is elsewhere?
Exactly. I think there are two things going on here. One, for students, it has created an environment of fear, uncertainty, and anxiety. And they're looking for answers. And at the same time, campuses don't have the answers because these are not usual processes. So campuses are unable to answer so many of the questions that their current students, their existing students have. And at the same time, they're also working to support them in all their regular academic concerns and looking to recruit the next class.
Yeah, so what does all that uncertainty mean for students, not just as they're finishing their school year and maybe in some cases finishing their college careers, but what does it mean for them sort of more broadly?
I think this creates a lot of questions in students' minds. So if you are uncertain if you're going to be able to finish your college career, if you're going to be unable to actually participate in what's called optional practical training post-graduation, that can actually mean, should I stay in the United States? So we have certainly heard from a number of institutions where students faced with what they have seen happening, in which their own records have been terminated for reasons that they don't understand, they've left the country. And while institutions are working to support those students to finish out the year, this is a loss for the students and it's a loss for the college and the community, because now we have lost that student's potential.
So do you think that we are going to see, maybe even as early as this upcoming fall, that when the new school year starts, that American universities will have fewer international students attending?
Let me address this in two ways. First, I do think that with this type of administrative actions, both that we've seen with the visa revocations, with the unilateral student record terminations, as well as other kinds of immigration enforcement, that yes, we will see a decline in new international student enrollment. I think most of the international students who are already here, who can participate in optional practical training, will seek to do so. So overall numbers may not see the decline, but new international student enrollment numbers, those that are thinking of coming for this coming fall, will reconsider. That said, Mark, let me also just highlight one important development in the visa revocations and student record terminations situation right now. Starting yesterday, we saw some student records being reactivated. And I think that we are starting to see this because court action, legal challenges make a difference.
Well, so I guess on a practical level, if there are in fact fewer international students, I would imagine that would impact universities' financial situations, right? Because international students tend to pay higher tuition than in-state or even out-of-state students.
I would say that we can think about the harmful impacts in three ways. First is the impact, direct impacts on American students. Many American students don't go abroad. For them to prepare for the global competitive world, it is often through their interaction with international students on their campuses. So while I know we focus on revenue, I think we also have to focus on the experience that American students benefit from having international students in their classrooms, on their campuses, learning from international students, being able to work in global teams. Second, yes, I think the direct impacts on institutions, less international students, less revenue, but also think about less research productivity. Because the other thing that we know about international students and scholars is that they increase the research productivity of our institutions. And then finally, Mark, I'll just talk about the rippling impacts on our businesses and industries in Arizona and across the US. And that is less international students really can translate in a type of brain drain for the US, because their loss is going to be our loss in filling skill shortages, in spurring entrepreneurship, in boosting economic growth, and fueling our workforce.
Do you think that all of the actions that are taking place on university campuses across the country, and I guess maybe also sort of the concerns about the Trump administration's immigration policies more broadly, is all of that making the U.S. a less desirable spot for international students to go to higher education?
The US is in an increasingly global competitive marketplace for international student talent. We already see across the world other countries who are actively working to recruit international students as well as retain their students in the countries. So, for example, India and China have many initiatives to ensure that their students don't all go abroad. So, first, we're in an increasingly globally competitive world. Second, yes, I think that what we're starting to see under this administration is once again prospects of policies and rhetorics that will deter international students from choosing the US for their study and career pathways.
All right. That is Miriam Feldbloom, President and CEO of the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration. Miriam, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Arathi Krishnan is a 20-year veteran in the world of humanitarian aid and international development. But over the years, she's sometimes found herself disappointed with leadership at the organizations she partners with. Too often, she says, in spite of their good intentions, they're caught flat-footed by crises they should have seen coming. Fortunately, however, Krishnan thinks she has a solution: imagination. As she recently told my co-host Sam Dingman, it's an idea that grew out of a series of frustrating post-mortem conversations with her peers.
It was always the same thing. We didn't see this coming. We weren't prepared. We were taken by surprise. I kept thinking, well, this is not right. Why are we not thinking about the future? Why are we assuming that things are just going to keep happening the same way? And when we keep making those assumptions, it's the people that are already disenfranchised, already underrepresented, already in moments of fragility that bear the brunt of our lack of imagination.
Could you give me an example of what you're describing, a situation where something happened that in your mind could have been foreseen if the stakeholders had been a little bit more imaginative?
Back in, I think I want to say 2015, maybe, just when the Greek migration crisis was happening, and we had a lot of people that were fleeing the conflict in Syria. We were going by this assumption back then that what people needed when they arrived as refugees or asylum seekers or whatever, that what they needed was food, water, and shelter. And in fact, the first thing people asked for was, where can I charge my phone? And so the assumption that people were making back then was that if you were fleeing or seeking asylum, you were poor, you were uneducated, you needed the very basics. But in fact, people fleeing Syria were none of that. They were middle class, extremely educated people that were fleeing a situation outside of their control.
Interesting, interesting. So there was this picture, it sounds like, in the heads of some notional humanitarians of what a refugee is.
Looks like. Yeah.
So what do you think accounts for this lack of imagination?
We often, as human beings, tend to think that the world will continue to unfold the way it's always unfolded. We also, as human beings, have trouble believing that something that seems implausible, seems ridiculous, could actually occur. But as humanity, we've been proven wrong on all those accounts. Just in the last 5 years, the amount of shock as we have handled over the last 5 years alone has shown us that everything that we thought was implausible can actually happen. The sort of things that we thought would never happen to us is actually happening. So I think it is a bit of myopic thinking on our parts as human beings, and certainly on the parts of decision makers that hold on to a lot of power that don't want to imagine a different status quo. What we want, I believe, is disruption as long as it doesn't decenter our own safety and privilege. Nor are we raised in cultures like indigenous cultures that prioritize dreaming. I'm Australian. We grew up with our indigenous elders that actually have dream time, that talk about the importance of dreaming.
I'm glad you brought up your own experience with this, because I'm curious to know about your relationship with imagination. Is it something you've always felt like you're in close touch with, or was it something that was an outgrowth of the professional work you've done?
So I was born in Malaysia and back then, as Southeast Asian kids, science fiction wasn't really a thing for us. But I, from a very young age, always had my face in a book of fairy tales.
Uh-huh.
And then when I started to get into the work that was really important to me, I started to see how the limitations of our ability to imagine something new was actually holding us back as people that want to do good, and as communities that want to serve.
So can you think of an example, once you kind of arrived at this idea of needing to introduce imagination into the work that you do with institutions, can you think of an example where you encouraged somebody to think that way, or maybe brought your own imaginative idea into a situation and you saw the benefit of it?
I started integrating this into my professional work back when I was based in Geneva. I was with the International Federation of Red Cross, and we decided to use futures and imagination as one part of how we designed the global strategy. We decided to run a consultation with young people entirely on WhatsApp.
Okay.
And so we partnered with university, the Red Cross youth volunteers would engage with a group in the same sort of region, not sub-region, but region. And one of the things we took away from that was that climate change was such a huge issue. And when we ran this process, when we were distilling the data down, what I learned from that was that young people in Europe, the things that were really important to them around climate change were issues of sustainability, young people in the Middle East, the issues that were important to them were around their safety and security. That if land and water became a lot more scarce, would they get displaced? Would they have to flee for their lives? So their safety and security were really important. For young people in the Pacific, it was something completely different. It was around the sense of identity and home. So when they thought about climate change and the future, what they were thinking about was, well, who am I? If Kiribati doesn't exist anymore because it's projected to sink, then who am I? Where do I belong? Where is home? Huh. And so you take this one broad blanket of climate change, but then the nuance of what young people were concerned about, and this is almost, what, a decade ago, you start to see the nuances in that.
That's so interesting. That's so interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, it's like if you have a sustainability strategy that is focused on personal safety, the kind of practical concern of personal safety, that might not be very meaningful to somebody for whom climate change represents more of an existential identity threat.
Yeah.
What are some of those tools or exercises that you implement to get people thinking this way?
You can write a story. Like if you imagine yourself in the future and you're sending a postcard back to your current self, what is that story telling you? When I was at the UN, we actually created a whole toolkit. We worked with designers in India and with young communities in Southeast Asia and South Asia and the Pacific, where we asked them, instead of drawing on, you know, science fiction movies or books where they think about the future, to actually draw on things that they grew up with that was indigenous to their cultures. So whether it was on indigenous perspectives, whether it was on principles of mythology or lore, what were the things that they were taught from their parents or grandparents or anything else that they wanted to draw on to imagine their futures? Mm-hmm. I think what it unleashes are ideas about the future that are very relevant to who we are as an individual person, that we design futures that we can see ourselves in rather than futures that we copy and paste from somebody else, from the Elon Musks of the world, and try to fit into those spaces.
Wow. Well, Arathi Krishnan is the executive director and founder of Raksha Intelligence Futures. Arathi, thank you for this fascinating conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how the nonchalant approach can be counterproductive to society. But first, Governor Hobbs late last week signed a bill into law that to provide funding for the rest of the fiscal year to a program that helps residents with developmental disabilities. This had turned into a big political fight at the Capitol, with GOP lawmakers accusing the governor's office of financial mismanagement and the governor threatening to veto any bills until she got a compromise resolution to the issue. The episode has led my next guest to bemoan what he's calling the sorry state of state government politics. Bob Robb is a longtime observer of Arizona government and politics and writes a Substack about it. He joins me to talk more about this. And Bob, let's start with that phrase, which you use as the headline of your latest piece, the sorry state of state government politics. What to you was so problematic about this whole situation?
That it was, and it's about the politics, not the substance. It's the, as Casey Stengel said, with respect to the 1962 Mets, can't anybody here play this game? you begin with an obvious omission by the governor. It was known in advance that one element of the developmental disability program was going to be subject to a federal matching fund. Mm-hmm. It was a new program. Federal government picked up all the costs for most of it. It was known that it was going to run out and that Arizona was going to have to come up with a cost-sharing component. But it wasn't budgeted for. Then, rather than focusing on solving the problem, the Republicans in the legislature decided to make a big deal out of fiscal mismanagement by the Hobbs administration, ignoring the fact that as architects of the school voucher program, they were actually far more guilty of underestimating participation in and the cost of, a major state program.
A point that the Hobbs administration has made.
It has made, but, you know, shame on both their houses. Both reveal a lack of physical management, but trying to make that political point against the governor in that context just wasn't going to do you much politically. And then they accentuated that when it became obvious that their proposed reform wasn't going to have the votes to pass. Rather than accept that reality, and here we got time running out, money's going to run out, May 1, they stack the Appropriations Committee with three new members in order to bang out of that particular committee this cap that wasn't going to be able to be passed on the floor. And so what's the political point of that? All you've done is to demonstrate a degree of mean-spiritedness in terms of the politics of the issue to accomplish nothing.
Why do you think it is that it all went down the way it did?
I think there's nobody there who knows how to play this game anymore. It's a little of an unfair criticism of Hobbs. I think it's probable that she doesn't have anywhere near the political skills of two Democratic predecessors who had very successful administrations, even though they had Republican-controlled legislators, Bruce Babbitt and Janet Napolitano. But it's also true that she's dealing with a magnified Republican legislature that doesn't have the same commitment to governance that the traditional Republicans that Babbitt and Napolitano dealt with. That's illustrated by what they've done with her appointments to fulfill her cabinet.
So going back to the Babbitt and the Napolitano administrations, as you point out, they both had Republican majority legislatures. I would imagine, I remember the Napolitano administration. I don't remember the Babbitt administration. I wasn't here for that. But I would imagine that both of those had their fair share of political gamesmanship, right?
Oh, absolutely. Political gamesmanship was part of the game, and that's part of playing the game. But as I said, in those days, there was a greater interest in, at the end of the day, good governance that created a bridge. The Babbitt administration was incredibly productive. We had the Groundwater Management Act. Mm-hmm. We had the Urban Lands Act to create orderly development on state lands near the urban footprint. Arizona joined the Medicaid program. The authorizing legislation for a half-cent sales tax in Maricopa County to finally build a freeway system was passed. Mm. So you have a remarkable period of productive government. Napolitano's gains were more ephemeral, but perhaps more politically instructive. Either consciously or by default, sort of the operating agreement, the way to get to good governance, was to do what both sides thought were most important. So Napolitano got substantial increases in university and K-12 funding, including state-paid all-day kindergarten.
Yeah.
And the Republicans got tax cuts and an expansion of school choice. If you look at the current legislature-governor relationship, the largest thing that they've done is to squander a $2.5 billion surplus on pork barrel spending.
So to you, are these more ideological differences now than what we've seen in the past? Is it personality-based? Is it relationship-based? Like, what do you think is different now than what we've seen in the past?
I think the largest change is the MAGA takeover of the Republican Party and superordinating scoring political points against the Democrats well over and above an interest in actually governing. Hobbs, I don't think, has played the hand that she's been dealt particularly well, But on the other hand, it's kind of hard to contemplate what she could have done differently that would have produced a better result.
At the same time, though, it's worth noting that at the end of the day, they did come up with an agreement that was largely a compromise, right? Like the governor got some of what she wanted. The Republicans in the legislature got some of what they wanted. And both sides had stuff that they liked and disliked in that bill. So in that sense, does that maybe give you hope that maybe this is more like the Napolitano-Babbitt model than what we've seen over the last couple of years?
No, it strikes me as the exception that proves the rule. Mm. I think it was the publicly empathetic constituency at stake and a hard deadline of running out of money that created that dynamic. There's not that much distance between Republicans and Democrats on the two big issues confronting the state, water and housing. And yet there doesn't seem to be any political path forward to doing anything about those. We had a sufficient surplus that could have tided the state over a couple tight revenue years that were completely squandered because they couldn't come up with any other approach to developing a state budget and not shutting down state government. We're now in a very dicey situation with respect to the state budget because of the large question mark over what the economy is going to do. And at least to even a fairly observant outside figure, not much substantively going on down there to try to figure out a path forward.
All right. That is Bob Robb, longtime observer of Arizona politics, has a Substack now. Bob, thanks as always for coming in. Nice to talk to you.
Always good to be with you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. It is the time of year when much of the valley turns a shade of yellow as Palo Verde trees bloom. It's a telltale sign of spring, especially in a region where spring can sometimes feel more like summer. But unlike other places that celebrate signs of the seasons, think cherry blossoms in D.C., you tend not to see that kind of thing as much here. With me to talk about this is valley artist Jen Urso. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing all right. So what do you think about, I mean, you're somebody who does a lot with maps and mapping in your art. What do you think about when you see, you know, these bright, beautiful yellow blooms on trees across the valley?
Well, it always feels like a magical time of the year. In fact, just the other day, I was sitting in a traffic light with my son in the car and looking at this tree next to like a McDonald's and, you know, it was bursting in yellow and yellow all over the ground. And I said, you know, isn't this just amazing? Like, it's this time of year where everything is just painted in yellow here. And then he pointed out that it matched the McDonald's logo. I said, yes, very on brand.
Yeah. I mean, so for some of us, obviously, this time of year means a trip to get your allergy shots. But like, for a lot of people, this can really feel like sort of how we in the valley identify spring, because we don't really have, you know, the cold winters where you're forced to stay inside. And, you know, like me, you're from the East Coast originally. Like, there's just a sort of a different way of marking the time, it seems, here.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the first time, I don't know if like the having moved here from Pennsylvania, like about 30 years ago, I don't know if I really noticed it right away. Like, it didn't really register to me that this was something that was cyclical. But then it started to become a thing of like, what is happening when everything is yellow, you know? And then it sort of slowly dawns on me that, oh, it's, you know, connected, you know, just even as a person myself, who I feel is pretty connected to nature, I still had that disconnect of understanding that this was something specific to this place that is really special, that happens at a very specific time of the year.
So why is it then that, like, there's not more attention? Like, it seems like the Palo Verde blooms don't get the love that, you know, cherry blossoms do in D.C. I mean, people don't flock here this time of year to see this the way they do in Washington, D.C. and other places that have similar kinds of sort of especially spring rituals.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just an unfortunate consequence of Phoenix being believed to be this place that could be anything, you know, by settlers who came in and thought, okay, well, we can, it's this blank slate. We can plant whatever we want. We can grow whatever we want, you know? So it's a, like this embedded lack of appreciation of what's indigenous to this area. I mean, I think the pride of Phoenix and of the Sonoran Desert has changed a lot, at least since I've been here. Mm-hmm. So I think people are embracing it more. I mean, I did hear recently that there was a blossom festival at the Acatia restaurant, I think by some landscape architect, like a landscape architect group.
Okay.
So there's definitely, I think, a better appreciation. But I remember there being a time when people were like complaining about it. Like, oh, God, all this yellow. And I'm like, how can you complain about this? This is unbelievable. You know, this is beautiful. These blossoms are falling around us and cast, you know, raining on us. And I don't know how that could be turned into a thing that anyone could complain about.
I mean, I guess maybe if you have to, you know, brush them off your windshield all the time or, you know, sneezing, stuff like that could be the only complaint.
It seems a small price to pay for, you know, like natural beauty.
Sure. So like, how do you try to use this, especially the Palo Verde bloom in the work that you do? I mean, is this the kind of thing that you maybe try to highlight a little bit to try to, you know, get people to appreciate this kind of thing in this time of year more?
Well, for me, what I appreciate about a lot of native plants and what I try to do, especially in my own piece of land, is having plants that have a really good, what they call leaf drop. So, you know, it helps enrich the soil. So as long as you're not, you know, what's the word? The leaf blower, like getting dust blower, blowing everything
yeah.
away, and you're letting that stuff drop, it's really helping the soil become, you know, richer. There's a healthier biome. You know, so for me, like I have a blue Palo Verde in my yard, which I guess actually blooms a lot earlier than some of the hybrid Palo Verdes that you see around town. I wasn't afraid to have the one with the thorns. but like it's such an appreciation for me because like my goal is to really try to get the soil in my yard back to where it should be, or, you know, where it was originally before it was hit with like chemicals and gravel and landscape fabric and all this kind of stuff. And it is slowly getting to that point. So, you know, creosote's a really good example of something that drops so many wonderful leaves and it creates
yeah.
like a really good mulch at the base of the plant. So I think of it as, you know, it's just a way of the desert protecting its soil for, you know, for this summer, the brutal summer that's coming up. It allows a harbor for insects and microbes and, you know, leaf blowing it all away is kind of defeating the purpose of what this tree, this wonderful tree that survives our environment, is trying to do, you know?
Sure. All right. We'll have to leave it there. That is Valley artist Jen Urso taking the time to appreciate the yellow Palo Verde blooms. Jen, good to talk to you as always. Thank you.
Awesome to talk to you. Thanks.
The warming climate has all kinds of implications for all kinds of aspects of our ecosystems. Research from Northern Arizona University finds even a slight temperature increase in boreal forests can lead to less snow, which in turn leads to other changes. Andrew Richardson is a professor of ecosystem science at NAU, and he says the research also applies to other forests, including those in Arizona. I spoke with him last year, and we started with whether it's a fair assessment to say that the data seem to suggest that there's this kind of vicious cycle going on when the temperature is warm, even just a little bit, on pretty much everything in the ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, I think the take-home message of the paper is really that it's not like we're approaching a tipping point where warming is going to have major impacts on the amount and duration of snow cover. We're at that point already, and future warming is virtually guaranteed to have a major effect on winter snow cover.
So with less snow, there are obviously implications for plant life, for runoff and water in certain parts of the country, but it seems as though there are also pretty significant implications for the forests themselves.
Yeah, you know, I think we'll see lots of changes in the future. With less snow, you don't have that insulating blanket that protects the upper layers of the soil from extreme cold, and so That can lead to increasing freeze-thaw cycles in the soil. That can damage fine roots. That can affect plant growth and nutrient cycling. Also, low-lying plants, low shrubs and things like that, if they don't have a blanket of snow cover on them in the winter, they can be more subject to temperature swings as well, and that can damage foliage and have, you know, negative impacts on the health of those plants going into the next growing season.
What does that mean potentially for the biodiversity of those forests?
Well, I think some plants are just more sensitive to freezing temperatures than others, and we might see those declines in populations of those species and other hardier species better able to survive through that freezing, and we may see increases in populations of those species.
If there are plants and other foliage that are damaged during the winter, does that potentially have implications for warmer times of year and potential wildfires going through those areas if there is sort of more unhealthy or dead trees, plants, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, the freeze-thaw cycles are not going to have such a major impact on the above ground parts of trees because they're already elevated above the snow. But damaging the fine root systems could impact the health of the trees, could increase fuel loads. I think the real implication, though, for forest fires is just going into, without that sort of big wetting event in the spring when snow melts, we're going to go into summer with drier soils. And that is going to give us a elevated risk of forest fires.
What are the implications of just in general having less snow? I mean, you talked about how, you know, that kind of leaves the forest floor a little bit maybe more vulnerable to the freeze-thaw cycle. But I would imagine that less snow is not ideal here either.
No, I mean, I think some people may be relieved. They won't have so much snow to shovel. There may be fewer accidents related to snow and ice on the roads. Fewer resources will have to be allocated towards plowing. Those may be seen as positives, but there's going to be fewer opportunities for snow play and sledding. The ski season will be a bit shorter, mud season a bit longer. I think Flagstaff won't seem like an exotic winter destination for the residents of Phoenix and Tucson. So our tourism industry will suffer. We'll go into summer with those drier soils and elevated risk of forest fires. We'll probably see more forest closures and fire bans. And then reduced runoff in spring and summer is going to also impact river flows, and that could negatively impact whitewater recreation. So there's going to be these carryover effects that extend beyond the December to March period and affect not just sort of the health and productivity of the forest, but many of the services on which our society relies that forests provide.
Yeah, it sounds like in addition to sort of the scientific impacts, there are economic and financial impacts here as well.
Yeah, I think that that's going to be huge. Places like Flagstaff, you know, we're kind of right on the edge of some years we have a good snowfall, some years we don't. On warm days, that snow melts pretty quickly. And if there's less snow to begin with, we're just going to see a major reduction in snow cover in the future with any additional warming.
Right. So does what you learned in this research change the way you think about climate change and the impacts of climate change at all?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, my expectation was that a little bit of warming wasn't going to change snow cover much at all. And it was only when we got to the higher levels of warming in that experiment that we'd see major reductions. But the fact that any warming above where we're at right now causes reductions in snow cover, that's a big concern for me.
And did you find that it sort of goes up exponentially, that, you know, you lose maybe a little bit of snow cover at minimal warming, but as it gets warmer and warmer, the amount of snow goes down in some correlating way?
Yeah, so what I didn't anticipate was that the effects would generally be biggest with small amounts of warming, and then they would be smaller as the warming increased. But that's largely because as the warming increases, there's so little snow left to begin with that it just there's not that much more to lose, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, as you have less and less, losing even a little bit doesn't seem like such a big deal because you didn't have that much to begin with.
right, when you're at 3 days of snow cover per year, whether it's two or four doesn't really make a big difference.
Right. Do you think that, based on what you found, that the forests themselves could stand to undergo some kind of significant change? Like if there is an increase in the freeze-thaw cycle and certain plants maybe don't do as well as others or trees, does that sort of change the nature of the forests themselves?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the bigger effect there is going to be rapid. You know, trees are fairly resilient, but if we see more large fires because of these drier soils, those fires could really accelerate the shift from, say, ponderosa forest to pinyon and juniper woodlands or something like that. I think that the fire is a key mechanism there that we didn't study in this research, but would make sense here in northern Arizona in the ponderosa forests.
All right. That is Andrew Richardson, a professor of ecosystem science at Northern Arizona University. Andrew, thank you very much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks. It was great to chat, and I hope you have a great day.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Last month, in an opinion essay for ASU State Press, reporter Sam Tracer took issue with what he views as an epidemic of nonchalance. He has strong feelings about what's necessary to counter this alarming trend, which he recently shared with my co-host, Sam Dingman.
Sam, I want to start actually with the last two lines of your piece, which are start dreaming, start chalanting.
Yeah.
What is chalanting for you?
I mean, it is just not being nonchalant. It is taking down that facade of, you know, not caring for the sake of looking cool and just kind of unashamedly being yourself and doing what you want to do for the sake of doing it.
And so the inspiration for this piece came from watching an awards acceptance speech. What was that speech?
So Timothée Chalamet received, I believe it was the SAG's award for actor and for his role as Bob Dylan in The Complete Unknown. And he said in the speech, he took a pretty distinct route. He says, I know people don't usually say this.
I know the classiest thing would be to downplay the effort that went into this role and how much this means to me. But the truth is, this was 5.5 years of my life. I poured everything I had into playing this incomparable artist, Mr. Bob Dylan.
And then he goes to say, hey, I know people really don't usually say this, but
the truth is, I'm really in pursuit of greatness. I know people don't usually talk like that, but I want to be one of the greats. I'm inspired by the greats. I'm inspired by the greats here tonight. I'm as inspired by Daniel Day-Lewis, Marlon Brando and Viola Davis, as I am by Michael Jordan and Michael Phelps, and I want to be up there. So I'm deeply grateful to that. This doesn't signify that, but it's a little more fuel, it's a little more ammo to keep going. Thank you so much.
I remember being really struck by that too, and that it was so refreshing.
Yeah, that's the word I was exactly going to use to describe it.
Why was it so refreshing for you?
I don't really enjoy the fake humble act. I think it's nice to see people really see, hey, I'm capable of this. I went out and put in work and I did it. I think that's really refreshing, and I think people having that confidence with themselves, it's what we need a lot more of.
Yeah, I think there is really something to the idea that he wasn't pretending that it wasn't hard. And you talk in the piece also about how this is sort of a classic American archetype, this idea that, like, I'm not affected by it. I'm cool. And it made me want to ask you, like, what's your relationship with that? Do you feel like your relationship with ambition is challenging?
I mean, I want to work in the civil rights field. I want to make a positive impact on the world, knowing that, you know, like 70 years down the line when I, you know, I'm not here anymore, I want to know that I made a substantial difference in the people in my lives and the people who I don't know yet. So at least in my case, I've always had ambition to, you know, go out and change stuff for the better. It's a lot more gratifying to see people, you know, authentically go out there and just be loud and be good.
Yeah. Well, the authenticity thing is interesting, and I wonder if it's related to another line from your piece that I really liked, which is, and this is a quote, you say, there is latent cringiness in trying to seem dark and mysterious. What is that cringe for you? What do you think it touches on?
It's inherently not nonchalant to seem nonchalant to, you know, put on this vibe. I think that someone kind of like press themselves and trying to, like, you know, maybe just be in the corner at the function or, you know, like just vague and, you know, like I said, like dark and mysterious than you actually are. I think there is just a lot of cringiness in that because it's not you. It's you're trying very hard to put on this mask.
Right. And it's like people who are doing that think that we can't see them pretending.
Yeah, that's
that
fair.
They don't care about something that they obviously care about tremendously.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if you talk to someone who puts on this guise, I found it very boring. I don't want to talk to a brick wall. I want to talk to someone who, you know, has, you know, taken their time on this world and has accumulated so many experiences and who wants to talk about them, want to see what gets them going. I don't want to talk to someone who responds in, you know, terse one-liners that, you know, they think they seem cool by saying. Why not be authentic? It's the only way to make good human connection. Because if you don't have this, if you make this connection with someone when you're putting on this facade, you're going to live with this insecurity that, hey, if, you know, I really, you know, take this mask off, become like, and like be like the quote unquote, like the real you, there is that worry that they're not going to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worry that the nonchalance thing, it runs this risk of you having to keep this facade going forever and ever.
Right. Right. Well, not to ask you to be a spokesperson for your entire generation, mm-hmm. but people of my generation, I'm a millennial, mm-hmm. a lot of us have heard this narrative that Gen Z, the generation that came along after us, was going to be the generation that saved the world because they were going to care so much about climate change. They were going to be more politically engaged than we were because they were from a generation of school shootings and things like this. And as we saw in the most recent presidential election, a lot of Gen Z folks didn't vote, at least in the numbers that some might have thought they would have. What do you make of that? I mean, do you see any of that in your life as a Gen Z person?
I can't stress how glad I am you asked that question. I personally, the Gen Z apathy in regards to politics is an incredibly real and an incredibly dangerous phenomenon. You watch and then you read more about the world and it punches you and crushes you down. But people tend to take all this bad news and then they use this thing of appeal of nonchalance to just repress it. So the nonchalance thing has very much not just emerged as, you know, a way to pick up girls or a way to seem dark and mysterious, but a way for many of my compatriots to just seem less worried by all the noise of the world.
Interesting. So it's almost like rather than give in to the despair of all of these terrible things that you see piling up all around you, you affect this air of not caring about any of it because to do anything else might be overwhelming?
Exactly. I think that the apathy thing has certainly emerged as a way for people to just not stay involved and therefore they won't stay overwhelmed.
But in the spirit of your piece, it seems like in spite of all that, you're still choosing to engage. You're still choosing to care.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me more about that voice inside of you that doesn't want to give up on chalance.
Yeah, I kind of have to. I have to stay involved. I mean, I am a straight white passing guy from Scottsdale, Arizona. I have grown up. I've had the luxury of having a lot of things that not a lot of people have had the ability to, you know, either partake in or I don't have the worries other people have. So it's you're kind of called to use your voice and use the and I know this is very buzzwordy, but use the privilege you have in order to ensure that others can have the same outcomes that I myself have had and hopefully will have. You kind of have to stay chalant. You have to stay, you know, active and always putting out a voice, making sure that you can use your platform to, you know, change other people's minds.
Is there anybody in culture that you look to besides Chalamet as an example of this?
Right now, I can't think of anyone, and I think that's the problem. I think the fact that there is no central figure that can easily come to mind for me as some example of raw and unbridled chalance, the fact that there is no one there that I can easily know, I think that's the problem.
Well, Sam Traister is a reporter at ASU's State Press and also a sophomore at ASU studying political science and business. Sam, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.